All right, the topic for every night this week is the principle of cause and consequence. It is a topic which everyone is familiar with, and everybody thinks they understand it because it seems so simple, it seems so clear that everybody thinks they really know it. But that's sort of a problem in itself. In these talks, we're going to do a little bit of review and a little bit of repetition to get at the foundational ideas of it and how it can be useful to us and some aspects of it where it can be detrimental to us. And we're going to try and look at it in ways that are the most useful. However, by the time that we get into it, you probably will not recognize it, because one of those things, when a person thinks they know it, they quit thinking about it, and they quit being creative. So day by day, this will sound less and less like cause and consequence sounds to most people. Now, the principle is universal. It seems to be built right into the consciousness of people, and it has always been part of culture throughout history. In the Bible, the saying is, as ye sow, so shall ye reap. In modern slang, in street language, we say, what goes around comes around. And we hear terms like payback or the chickens come home to roost. Those are all folk statements about the nature of cause and consequence. And most people have some kind of a sense of justice. And that sense of justice is not necessarily religious. It's not societal or philosophical. But we hear things from people, sometimes with a harsh tone of voice. They say, well, he got what he had coming to him. And that is with that sense of justice that people have. Now, despite the prevalence of the principle, few people think it out to understand how it works and what it means and what its purpose is. And that includes esoteric students. Most esoteric students do not think about cause and consequence. Few people apply it. And when it is applied, it's not necessarily applied in a pro-evolutionary manner. It's almost in a simple selfishness. So let's very simply try to state what cause and consequence is and what its ends are. In as simple a way as you can say it, it is that every cause has a consequence. It's similar to the principle of cause and effect in science, but it is not the same. Cause and effect in science states that every action results in an effective change. And that effective change is usually beyond the causal agency. Cause and consequence, on the other hand, doesn't disagree with the principle of cause and effect. But in the principle of cause and consequence, it is what redounds on the causal agent or agency, the being or the force that initiated the action, because the consequence comes back, and that's the important part of it. So in this sense, it is something like cause and effect plus action and reaction, whereby every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Now, it's helpful to simplify and clarify statements like this in terms of scientific principles, but it is usually dangerous to do that. For one thing, it oversimplifies things. Science, as we know it now, material science, is in its infancy. Science likes to reduce everything to the simplest possible way. Usually, it tries to produce one cause and one effect. And if there are multiple causes and multiple effects, especially the former, science doesn't know how to deal with it. It's just, you know, it hasn't graduated to that type of consciousness yet. In fact, a lot of hard scientists, like inorganic chemists, don't like dealing with a lot of organic chemistry or environmental things because they say it's not clean because they can't get it down to one simple cause and consequence. Another detriment to looking at cause and consequence in terms of simple scientific principles is that when you do that, it tends to depersonalize things. Now, the spirit is not personal, but it does address in a very close and intimate way all of the inner needs and everything that is within an individual. And to be harsh and cruel and cold in an impersonal way is not a healthy thing to do. That tends to happen anyway when you're dealing with cause and consequence. There are also dangers for people who personally identify with causes and consequence, especially if the cause or consequence has a bad attitude about it. What happens then is that some people see consequences as vengeance. That's what it means when somebody uses the term payback. It's a vengeance for what you've done. And people who are recipients with that kind of attitude think that the world is against me, or God is out to get me, or something like that. And so personalizing destiny is as much of a difficulty as being too impersonal about it. Now, after saying all of these things, it is true that the onus of responsibility is placed squarely on the individual as the individual becomes aware of his or her causal ability, or his or her causal agency. It's you cannot deny what you have or have not done. Very elementary things, since it's called a law or a principle or something like that, we have to make sure that we get a simple understanding that it's not like a human-made law. It's not like a traffic law or some statute or something like that, because it cannot be skirted. It cannot be violated in any way. We are responsible for what we have done. What you do is what you are responsible for. So we can't woodgy around it and say, well, I meant to do this or something like that. If you meant to do that, it's right on you. If we take this principle seriously, it is a very powerful tool for the awakening of consciousness, especially self-consciousness. That is one of its purposes within the evolutionary creation. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, we are taught that the religion that incorporated the law is a jihadistic religion. And the jihadistic religion purpose of it is breaking down racial connections or too strong of cultural binding. The purpose is individuation. And if a person becomes keenly aware of the consequences of the deeds, one becomes very much awake. It is individuation of the highest order to see what we have done, or to realize what we haven't done. So it's an important thing. Jehovah is the third member of the Holy Trinity. We won't talk about Jesus in that regard. We save that for a different time. The selfhood of Jehovah is found in the realm of human spirit, just as our selfhood is found in the human spirit. So the obvious conclusion of this is that if we want to awaken and develop self-consciousness, paying full attention to the principle of cause and consequence is very efficacious. It enhances that problem enormously. If we pay attention to our consequences and to our causes, it means that we take responsibility for everything that happens to us. Everything that happens to us. There are no accidents. There are creative acts by others, but there are no accidents. There are things that we often don't want to face up to. And there are things that we may never have imagined about ourselves or about our role in life. But when there are significant consequences in our lives, it behooves us to pay attention to them if we want to become self-conscious. After all, nothing is lost of experience. We have at least two panoramas of the main things that are going to happen to our life before we are born. There are memories of nature on several levels, in the ethers, in the world of thought, in the realm of life spirit. In all of them, there are memories. So nothing can be lost. Experience here. Experience here, which is our creative proving ground, is exceedingly important. It is here that we finalize things. It is here where we find out whether our creations or something new work in the resistance of matter. It's very important. Even the initiations of the Rosicrucian Order, we find that everything that we are in our initiations, we see our connections from past phases, when we were mineral-like, or when we were mineral-like humans. We see recapitulations of things that we have done in the past, so that we know that we are living integral parts of cosmos and not something separate that stands out from it. In order to know ourselves and to face ourselves, such as in third heaven before we come to birth, or when we have just seen the consequences of the life that we have completed, we have to take responsibility for our deeds, because in owning them is the only way we can dissolve them and take them as soul matter into our spiritual being. We're all striving to wake up. We're all striving to become more conscious. Waking self-consciousness is predicated on deliberation. When we apply causes causes, and we do so deliberately, that is where our self-consciousness is born. If we deliberate every action we take, if we do everything with complete self-consciousness, that is how we wake up. C.W. Ledbetter, who was a friend of Max Heindel, went to a master at one time in India, and he asked what he had to do to obtain clairvoyance. And he was told to do everything that he did as self-consciously and deliberately as possible. Even the trivial things in life, like putting a stamp on an envelope or something like that. This is a practice that is common to all worthwhile spiritual paths. Max Heindel and Rudolf Steiner called it concentration. Krishnamurti called it paying attention. Gurdjieff and Plato called it self-remembering. The Thich Nhat Hanh and the Buddhists call it mindfulness. By whatever name, it is the same process. On whatever is before one. Now from this we can see that by focusing attention on either the cause or the consequence, it awakens self-consciousness. And that self-consciousness is part of our individuation. So the function of cause and consequences, one of the functions is individuation. Because under the law, the self and the self-awareness develops. Now, if we are talking about cause and consequence, we're talking about action. The principle of cause and consequence is often called the principle of action. If there are no causes, there are no consequences. If there are no causes and consequences, there is no experience. And if there is no experience, there is no growth. So it's absolutely essential to spiritual growth that we do something. Actor, the doer, is just another name for the self. The thinker, another name for the Holy Spirit. The third attribute of every individuated being, from the supreme being to the lowest waking human being, the third attribute is always the attribute of action or motion or change, and that it is always the principle of cause and consequence. The rules of Christian philosophy teaches that experience is one of the main purposes for manifestation at all. And that goes to every level of being, including the supreme being. In fact, that is one of the central purposes of creative experience. We're here to experience, and by doing that, we are doing the same thing as the whole creation itself. It's creating, and from that creation there is experience. We're all spiritual students. As spiritual students with aspirations to spiritual growth, growth in consciousness, it behooves us to do this, to act. This doesn't mean that we do everything that comes our way. We do have to discriminate what is a more important action, what is a fruitful action. Sometimes we judge that. But by applying discrimination, and intuition about what we do and what we don't do is how we grow up. Now there are sins for incorrect doing and incorrect not doing. They are sometimes called in the West the sins of Lucifer and of Satan. They're called the sins of commission and omission, respectively. They are the sins of Mars and Saturn, or of Uranus and Neptune. If we do something, and this is something I'm sure you've all heard, if we do something for the hell of it, that's exactly what it is. It's for personal pleasure, it's just for the sake of doing something. That's a perfect example of the sin of commission. It is reveling in desire, it is reveling for personal ends in any kind of expression of energy, things of that nature. When we don't do something, when someone is suffering or is in need, and we have the capacity and the wherewithal to do something, that is a sin of omission. That person over there is being raped, but I'm not going to get involved. I don't want to be involved in that kind of a thing. That's a perfect example of omission, in that we are self-conscious and capable of intuition and judicial discrimination. We can determine what is right or wrong, or what is good or bad, and what kind of action to take. That is how we grow, and that's how we grow the most. We can become geniuses, and we can do all kinds of mental things, and add large numbers in our head and do all those kinds of things. But that isn't important as learning how to be a better person and how to correct what is necessary for other people. What we are and what we become is a direct result of what we have done and what we have not done. Our being, our character, even the shape of our body, is a consequence of the collection of all of our past deeds or not doing. Now, if we're self-honest, we realize there's a lot that we don't know. And if we have the humility to be open to that fact, and if we have this old stuff that has come from all of our past activity, intuition can be almost constantly available to us. But in the cases that we don't have intuition and we can't immediately figure it out, the Rosicrucian philosophy is that it's better to do something, because at least if you do something and make an error, you're going to learn from the experience. But if you're timid and constantly taken aback and unwilling to participate in life, you're not going to grow. That's how we learn, you know, suffering the consequences. If we do nothing, we experience nothing. And we become nothing, not even in our selfhood. We are doing beings, and we become by doing. There is a passive consequence to inaction. The consequence is progressive. We find ourselves progressively more filled with apathy and indifference. And we become so apathetic we aren't even aware of our condition. And we don't care, even if we are aware. And it's sort of a sliding into a gulf of despondency. like a lot of other slopes, it starts off very gently, and you say, oh, we're not in trouble. I just don't have to act right now. And a lot of slopes start out gently until they drop off precipitously. This philosophy of activism over pacifism is not universal to all schools of spiritual philosophy. Some schools teach that spiritual aspirants should be avoiding becoming ensnared in the realm of cause and consequence, and to rise above all of the busy work of causality. Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that schools of thought like that were developed at a time when we were losing the involuntary clairvoyance that we had, that we could see everything in the inner worlds, and the thought of losing it and passing into the grosser states of matter was a matter of panic. And so the philosophies were an extreme reaction to an abhorrence of blindness in matter and an abhorrence of losing touch with the divine nature. Now that philosophy is understandable, but it may not necessarily be correct. If we try to pull back, it's harmful to us. If we find ourselves falling and we do lurch efforts to keep from falling, we often injure ourselves more than if we see the fall as inevitable and just relax and fall. Those are more ancient philosophies. Modern philosophies have been waked up right here in this material blindness. And through intellection, we can see, even if dimly, that there is a purpose to everything. We have evolutionary awareness, not necessarily Darwinian awareness, but awareness that there is a mounting progress and that things are constantly metamorphizing and evolving to a better and better state of being, in which we can see more purpose to it all. Clearly, we can see the effects of the sin of the fall. We see that many of our human creations and actions are not at all harmonious to nature, which is the body of the unfallen spiritual activity. We have indeed created a deviate trajectory, passing as deeply into matter as we have. We have to correct it, but we must follow through. Anyone who has ever studied mental health realizes that if we do not follow through on actions, we produce an unhealthy state of consciousness. We're tentative, we're neurotic, and in a cosmic sense, human beings that do not follow through on their divine commitment to fulfill the creative purpose which we're not even capable of fully understanding yet, are in large-scale cosmic misunderstanding. Stopping participation in the ongoing evolutionary creation is not stopping where we stop smoking. Fortunately, in the world, there are not many attitudes that feel that we should pull out or drop out. And there are not many people that seek, perhaps in a selfish way, a blissed out state of consciousness, which often accompanies that. So the magnitude of selfishness as we proceed forward in matter and people are successful in creating in matter, selfishness is not as great as some would make it out to be. All of us want to unite with the divine, but we want to unite with it to serve it. And we're much too young in our service to be completely contemplative beings and create through our consciousness. We're not ready for that yet. It sounds almost like a sermon, doesn't it? When we say that, that every action has its equal and opposite reaction, or when we say that every causal action has a consequence, we're saying something that's quite grand. Because when we're saying that, we're not merely talking about energetic expression. We mean every causal action. Every thought, every desire, every mood, everything that we have in us. And this is something which is at present beyond our ability to grasp. It's way, way too big. There are some things about it, though, that even with our limited consciousness, beg a little bit of clarification. Obviously, causes like everything else, some are more important than others. If we wipe our nose with our left hand or our right hand, it's not as important as if we slap someone, or if we lie to someone, or if we deprive someone the continued existence on this plane. Those are much more grave, much more important things. Not sharing love when we should, even more important. When things like this are said, questions arise immediately. And we hear questions like, who judges the relative importance of consequences and causes? How is this determined in destiny? The answer to both is, we determine the relative importance. We determine how important something is to the ultimate purposes of reality. Cause and consequence is not something that's external. It's not outside of us. It's right within us. And consequently, it's right within our actions. There are not divine accountants who are counting every thought that we make, every emotion and every action. They're not tabulating them in some big abacus in the sky or something like that. And there are not beings that arbitrarily judge our performance on a scale from 1 to 10, like Olympic judges or something like that. That's not how it works. There are divine beings of higher consciousness that help us to understand. Especially they help us to understand some of our unconscious motivations. But the process of cause and consequence and self-awareness that comes from them is an automatic process. It's right within us. It's not mechanistic. It's not like some big destiny machine or something like that. It's right within our being, and it's right within our spiritual intent when we do something or when we refrain from doing something. It's right in the manifestation itself. No, we're going along the word. 3/4 done already. You said I could. What? No, I'm not kidding. These are designed to be no more than an hour long. This one probably less than that. So let's look at some examples to clarify these things. He doesn't believe it. See, experience is always new. You can't, you know, that because I've been long-winded and tedious in the past doesn't mean that I'm going to be in the future, especially in this talk. Obviously, if we are struck by a ping pong ball, it's less likely to be harmful to us than if we are struck by a cannonball with the same velocity. Now, this doesn't mean that the cannonball is more malefic. It's just a matter of the mass and the momentum of the cannonball. Thus, if we direct an angry thought at someone else, it's more momentous than thinking that somebody else is cute, or that appreciating something that they do. The cause, the action, carries everything of its nature right within itself. And it continues to do so when it becomes a consequence, and that consequence becomes a further cause. It isn't anything other than what we have made it to be. Consequences, you might say, are the flowering of our inner nature. It's where they are made manifest. Now, if we're struck by 100,000 ping pong balls, it's much more likely to be harmful, maybe even as harmful as being struck by a cannonball at the same velocity. So a single thought is not likely to have much of a destiny consequence. But that's not how we operate. We're much more likely to think the same thoughts over again and again and again. With repetition and with practice, it's even practice about negative things, it's likely to get stronger, and the same thing is true for thoughts and the things that the thoughts engender. Spiritual worlds are not like the solids of the physical world, where we see discrete particles and objects. Spiritual worlds are much more fluid, so fluid that we, with our slow materialistic consciousness, have a hard time following them. Spiritual worlds are also closer to the source of all unity. So there's much more attractiveness and coalescence between similars. Thus, thoughts produce formations, and thoughts and desires produce an amalgamum that has quite a bit of psychic momentum, if you want to use that kind of a term. Rarely do we have only just one desire, the exclusion of every other desire. We usually have moods, and we have attitudes that produce a prevalent atmosphere, and in that atmosphere there are all kinds of thoughts and emotions. And that's really what our character is. Our character is a consequence of many thoughts and attitudes and moods and everything else. So our destiny can't be anything other than what we've made it to be by our consciousness. That part is really simple. That's how we grow. That's how we become conscious. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy, like many spiritual philosophies, knows the importance of repetition. In the evolutionary creation, with all of the periods, revolutions and the globes and the epochs and all of those things, the spirals within other spirals until it's almost infinite, there are countless or almost countless repetition. And very slowly, like minimalist music, we very slowly metamorphize. And we develop and bring different facets of the spirituality into manifest being. If we bear that in mind, we must again repeat how important it is to pay attention and to deliberate as much as we can over every cause, for better and often for worse. Our intentions, Our thoughts, our desires, our deeds are made in various states of unconsciousness. We are not really awake to what we really are. We would be awed by knowing what we really are spiritually. We wouldn't even believe it was us. It would be so divine. People who manifest creations that come from their true spiritual being say that it was given to them by God, and they're right in a way, but that's really what God within them is. We'd also be chagrined by the demonic things that we have in our own character by letting ourselves go to seed and become the dark beings that we have become in the unconsciousness. So we have unconscious attitudes, and we have a lower nature that functions beneath the threshold of our waking consciousness, and only every now and then do we get a glimpse of it. And sometimes our divine nature, sometimes our lower nature initiates causes. And the more, this is where our spiritual exercises come in, the more that we can bring our waking consciousness into the realm of our true divine spiritual nature, the more we can participate and enjoy the creation and fulfill it. So what happens when things come from the unconscious or semi-conscious things? We hear people say things, oh, I forgot myself, or I didn't mean to do that, or that just came out of me. I think we've all done things like that without recognizing that they're really part of us. Again, it's a lot of repetition in this talk. Our attitudes are carried right within our causes and our consequences. They're right within our destiny. Even if we both have the same things happening to us. That's the only difference between a spiritual life and a non-spiritual life. The same events may be happening. And for one person, it's a wonderful thing. And for another thing, it's, so what? You know, it's because of the attitude that we have toward life. The ultimate source of cause and consequence is within our spiritual being. So cause and consequence are basically divine and basically good. Cause consequence are basically divine and basically good. The Bible tells us, right? The Bible tells us God is a spirit and must be worshipped in spirit and in truth. The Bible also tells us God is not a respecter of persons. And that's the way destiny is. Destiny is really quite interesting. Destiny is ironic. Destiny is poetic justice. We get exactly what we need, exactly when we need it, and exactly how we need it. Our every need is taken care of. Sometimes it's kind of embarrassing that we have to have things brought to us in the way that they are brought to us. Because we are as unconscious as we are, and we haven't done the work to be awake, it often seems as if something is wrong. In a very, self-patronizing way, we do identify with the divine. And very often we have those thoughts, this shouldn't be happening to me. Well, if it shouldn't be happening to me, it wouldn't be. It's just as simple as that. Sometimes we're not cognizant about what we say or what we do until it is fed back to us. I was a beatnik back in the late 50s and early 60s. And in the slang, when we'd say, instead of like we say, help yourself now, we would say, knock yourself out. You know, say somebody say, can I borrow this joint from you? And he'd say, yeah, knock yourself out. And I said that to someone once who was a lyricist. And And I said that, and he said the word right back to me, knock yourself up. And that was the last time I ever used that phrase again. It was perfect feedback. It was, you know, it was giving back to me what I had been giving out. Now, this kind of specific destiny leads many people to believe in a personal God who looks after them and takes care of them sort of in the fashion that a parent takes care of a child. Now, in an unusual way, there is something to that. We are all foci of the universal spirit. Each one of us is the focus of God and a God in the making. And to our good and to the ends of the spirit, we are led and given what we need in order that the divine can be fulfilled. So there is something very special about it. But we are not special in a way of person or anything like that. Indeed, God is not a respecter of persons. Our personality is a concentrated focus of divine. It's an expression of the spirit. As such, it is a cumulative destiny character from all of our previous causes and consequences. We don't carry all of the details along, but the essence of everything is what goes into making our being, the flavor of what we are, the creativity that issues from our very inner being is a result of all, everything that we've done. Everything that we haven't done. It can't be any other way. We're not separate from the universe. We're not separate from the universal spirit. We're part of it. And the environment that is the cosmos is the environment in which we have become what we are. So our destiny can't be anything other than what it is we have made it to be. So if we're humble and we're functioning in our personalities and we can objectively accept what is coming to us, we can benefit from it. And we can benefit from our consequences instead of fighting them personally as we do. Say, why am I stuck here in Madison, Wisconsin? You know, that kind of a thing. Acceptance doesn't mean that we have an idle or a passive stance about the cosmos. Receptivity and acceptance can be very active things. Even our senses, when we look, we see. Light and impressions of light don't just fall on our eyes as the psychologists think. We can give ourselves to the process and we can get that much more out of it. So the acceptance and receptivity are also part of the whole cause and consequence train of doing things. So this is not suggested that we have an idle stance toward cause and consequence, but that we maintain a spiritual objectivity about everything that occurs. God is not a respecter of persons, and there's no reason for us to be. And we'll break there, and we'll continue tomorrow along the way, and we'll get a little bit deeper into some other things. And for now, we'll do the Rosicrucian Students' Prayer together. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Yes. horoscope.
The
whole horoscope is all of the causes that have become ripe right now. And the whole horoscope is the potentials that are open for us to take that, what is in those causes and consequences, and direct them in a creative way. Yes. That's going to be covered in a later talk. It's a very excellent question. Love and the law, or grace and cause and consequence, we're going to get to that later on.
Okay.
It's a very big thing. It's one of the themes that has occupied my life. So I'll have a little bit to say about it. Go ahead. The last line of the talk? God is not a respecter of persons, which in it's sort of an older form of English, which means to say, well, this person has a certain special title and a dignity. I'll treat this person differently. It's living with cause and consequence as a spiritual philosopher is what you hillbillies would call the middle way. It is, you are, hillbillies is what we jokingly call the Tibetan, the Tibetan Buddhists.
Yeah.
We're the Christian mystics are the new kids on the block. And on one hand, you have to have that firm objectivity of the law, but not with having an attitude that is judgmental and that is harsh. And if you can be within that, and if you can see a higher and a better purpose, you know, from the causal levels, the higher causal levels that have initiated an action or that a person has come into their personal being by, then it's a very marvelous way of living. Hard though, because you know, in our egoism we want to be treated as special, and when you make somebody special in that very personal way, you make someone unspecial. And you make someone, you know, that's a bad guy, that's a good guy, and all of that, rather than seeing with a very neutral clarity. Yes.
You said that Jehovah was associated with the human spirit.
Yes.
And was there to separate us from.
Yes.
I thought he was a tribal god.
Yes, but that's the whole thing. At one time, all of humanity was an unconscious one. We were total. And then that was broken into races and cultures and things like that. And finally it gets down to the individual. And the agency that brings it down to the individual is what is called the Holy Spirit. And yes, so the religion of Jehovah is the religion of the law. Because first it starts out with religious laws. You can only eat this food, and your customs must be this and this. And eventually it gets down to the point where the law is found within, and then a person individualizes by being completely conscious of every deed. Yes. Yes. When we went from away from being a universal humanity where we loved each other and understood each other because of that oneness that we were in, and we began the process of individuation, which was associated with languages and cultures and all of those things, that is what the Tower of Babel represents. And I think, you know, I don't like to be nostalgic about things. People are saying, oh, we're losing so many languages every year. I don't feel real bad about that. It's a mark that a lot of tribal consciousness is going away. Unfortunately, the monolithic society that we have right now is a formal, external monolithic society, but eventually we'll catch on. So the relationship of the third attribute of the spirit to the second, the life spirit or the Christ principle, is the universalizing, in the same way that the Jehovistic principle is the individuating. And all of our consciousness is suspended between the universal truth that is common to all and the particular manifestation within each individual. But the view of, for example, in Christian literature, the view of the Holy Spirit is different from ancient times to modern times. Clearly, if you look at the Old Testament, well, this is what John was talking about this afternoon, the sin against the Holy Spirit was the abuse of the creative energy, which was not just in sexual pleasure, but it was in magic and things like that. And in the New Testament, in St. Matthew's Gospel, I don't know the exact, I'm not a Bible sharp, so I can't tell you the fortune of the internet, though. sin against the Holy Spirit is clearly and indubitably stated by Christ as lying. So at the two ends of the spine, when you turn the energy downward and outward in personal satisfaction, that is, you're using the divine creative force in a wrong way. And when you are sinning against the truth, because the spirit of the truth is Jehovah, the thinker, the truth itself is again the life spirit, and between the individual truths or the spirits of truth in the Jehovistic nature in relation to the total truth, which cannot be intellectualized at all, even though the Greeks call it the intellect, is again where our consciousness is born. And so the sins against the Holy Spirit of that nature. All right, any other questions? Edgar's here at home, huh?
Not yet.
Not yet. Oh, okay. Oh, you missed the whole talk.
Not because of Edgar.
Yeah, I know.
He's arriving at 9:15.
Yeah.
I missed it for other reasons.
Yes, because you're popular and everybody wants your attention.
But I had very important things.
It's because you're charming and popular, and everybody wants you. Thank you very much.